This is Pure Decking show number 342 for Thursday, March 28th, whatever. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and...
This is a picture of Aquaman.
Tonight, I'm Morps, I'm drinking Bullet Bourbon, and we have Aryu. What's up, Aryu?
In honor of Aquaman, I am drinking water.
That worked. And we have MedMen. Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying I want my giant seahorse, and I want it now.
I draw your attention to the 20-foot impressive seahorse he's riding. I'm the first to admit that a massive fleet of giant, highly trained seahorses would be cool.
And I was worried about how we would fit these sound clips in. And MedMen is also here.
Tauntauns, Mr. President.
I'm drinking a beer and wondering where I can buy a Tauntaun to ride. Although I think I may be a little too far south.
This is a
may have to get a Velociraptor.
Of repto mammals native to the ice planet of Hoth. The stirring, unmistakable patriotism of the Velociraptor holding up a tattered American flag.
Is that enough of that yet?
Yes.
Pure Decking, the home of the index of the parliament or the senate.
It's the senate, yeah.
Words were said on the floor of the senate. Everyone be happy or shocked.
Why not both?
I live in a world where I've seen on a stage the president say he has an adequate sized penis and the senator discuss riding Tauntaun.
Can't say it hasn't been an interesting 3 years, Madman.
Yep, Trump the reality show. So, although, because everybody's been talking about Trump and the Mueller thing and, you know, Tauntauns, there hasn't been a lot of talk, at least stateside, of the EU Parliament adopting Article 13.
Oh, yes, memes have been outlawed.
11 and 13.
Yeah. So I've got the article from Torrent Freak here, and they're specifically talking about 13, but yeah, you're right, 11 was in there as well. So getting to it here, the European Parliament has adopted the new copyright directive. This includes the widely contested Article 13, which was renumbered Article 17 in the final text. Pirate Party MEP Julia Rita sees it as a dark day for internet freedom, but many copyright holders are happy with the result. In 2016, the European Commission first announced its plans to modernize EU copyright law. Initially, the plan received little mainstream attention, but over the past year, that changed drastically. Article 13 and Article 11 of the Copyright Directive, which were renumbered to Article 17 and 15 in the final text, were highly contested. Opponents repeatedly warned that the former would lead to upload filters and censorship, and the latter was framed as a link tax. At the same time, many rights holders groups, publishers, and other members of the creative industry embraced the proposals. They saw it as a much-needed lifeline to ensure fair remuneration on the internet. Today, the European Parliament voted on the final text of the proposed directive. First up was a proposal to reject the entire copyright directive. This was rejected with 443 votes against and 181 in favor. A subsequent vote allowed amendments to the text of the directive, which was also rejected, but very close, 317 in favor and 312 against. Parliament then moved on to vote on the entire text of the copyright directive without any changes, including the renumbered Articles 13 and 11. With 348 members of Parliament in favor, 274 against, and 36 abstentions, the copyright directive was adopted. The decision comes as a major disappointment to the Pirate Party MEP Julia Reda, who has been one of the most vocal opponents of the copyright directive. Earlier today, she urged her colleagues to reject the plans and moments ago described the outcome of the vote as a dark day for internet freedom. Reda, who's the vice president of the Greens EFA group, says they will continue to fight against the new European law. This new copyright law, as it stands, threatens a free internet as we know it. Algorithms cannot distinguish between actual copyright infringement and the perfectly legal reuse of content for purposes such as parody, Rita notes. Obliging platforms to use these upload filters will lead to more frequent blocking of legal uploads and make life difficult for smaller platforms that cannot afford expensive filter software. Article 13, now 17, requires many for-profit internet platforms to license content from copyright holders. If that is not possible, they should ensure that infringing content is taken down and not re-uploaded to their services. Many rights holders groups are pleased with the outcome. Francis Moore, CEO of the music group IFPI, was quick to thank lawmakers for their efforts and is looking forward to seeing the changes implemented. This world-first legislation confirms that the user upload content platforms perform an act of communication to the public and must either seek authorization from rights holders or ensure that no unauthorized content is available on their platforms. The directive also includes a stay-down provision requiring platforms to keep unlicensed content down. Another global first, Moore adds. Oh, I have some... Let me finish the article. With the support of the European Parliament, the copyright directive will now... be sent to the council, which has to formally adopt the law. This is likely to take place in 2 weeks on April 9th. There's still a chance that a member state, such as Germany, withdraws its support in the council, which would mean that further negotiations are required. This could introduce delays beyond the European elections on May 23rd, 2019. If the copyright directive is adopted by the council, EU member states will have to implement the text in local legislation. This won't happen right away, but could take up to 2 more years. So... this law is being passed by a bunch of people who do not understand the technology they are regulating. They are basically asking for unicorns here. Oh no, these platforms have to ensure that any infringing material stays down. How the fuck are they going to do that? In any practical means, how are they going to do that?
Look, the software and the hardware doesn't exist to implement this to start with.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Let me know if I'm out of line here. It would require some sort of AI that we don't even have yet to regulate every upload. And then what happens if, say, a couple of jokesters decide to organize on a mass upload one day? Maybe topple over the new Overlord AI? By overloading it? I don't know, man.
The EU will just send in members of the new EU army that they're working on to execute the offenders, obviously.
Well, I mean, that's what I would do. I would organize
the way
that
it would work, same day uploads aren't going to exist anymore.
Yeah, everything would have to be reviewed. It would make it infeasible to run.
In addition to same day uploads not being permitted, you would need to register your YouTube account with something that actually ties it to you, like a driver's license number.
Well, that's where real-time registration, I think, is the next push for online news.
Your internet user's license.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to at least be with any platform. I'm using YouTube as an example because it's the largest.
Sure.
What they're going to do is everyone that has a channel and wishes to keep their channel is actually going to need to register with a state form of ID so they can keep track of who actually has the channel. Then anytime that you want to upload something to your channel, it doesn't immediately go up for view. You submit it to YouTube. They run it through whatever filter or have whoever review it, decide whether or not it has infringing material, and then either upload it or don't.
Well, they already have a content ID system they try to use now, but it doesn't work, at least not very well.
Not well.
You know, there have been plenty of cases where people have uploaded test videos of themselves talking to the camera. Like, literally, it's some dude sitting in his underwear at a webcam talking at the camera, right? And it gets flagged as, you know, infringing content. You know, there were people copyrighting the sounds of birds chirping or people breathing. or the wind, so that they could upload it to to YouTube's copyright system so they could try to claim monetization on other people's videos. This shit's not going to work. You're going to turn, and this may be the goal, you're going to turn social media platforms that allow content upload into only allowing licensed individuals, people who have previous agreements with them to, you know, behave well. And if you want to get in on that, you'll have to, you know, go through this process and all this. Basically, you're going to lock out everybody who's not already a big media player. That's the goal.
I don't see necessarily that, because I think anyone could just get their license. But I do see it going to a paid service rather than just hopping on YouTube and watching stuff for free, because we don't have software that can do the job. So they're going to have to pay someone to review videos.
That'd be the end of YouTube.
That's going to be added overhead. So they're going to start charging for their service.
That'd be the end of it.
Well, I don't know, Madman, because the last 2 weeks we've been under lockdown. And I am in some places in the internet right now that I never would have thought of going. And startups that I never thought were out there of different ways of communicating. One of the ones that we've got for... did you put that in for the show? That website issue?
For Dojo? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of them's coming up. There's a heap. I'm across three new broadcasting platforms right now. One is not live, but two are just getting feet. Yeah, some interesting stuff happening. And a lot of the people that have been locked out of the new market, as in not allowed back on YouTube, are actually starting their own stations like Galaxy 15, but they're spending a little bit of money for decent server size so they can have a large audience listen. It's like, I don't know how many we could have, but...
100?
100, yeah. Like, these guys pull thousands, you know what I mean? And they make 10, 15 grand a show.
Well, we've been doing this for 7 years and never advertised it, so...
Yeah. I don't think I want to get big, but we're not having that discussion. But, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of people just go, fuck YouTube, fuck Facebook, fuck Twitter. We're going to play over here where no one knows about it, and this is great. We can call each other faggots all day long and not get the ban hammer wheeled on us.
So
that's like fun for not getting banned by YouTube, but that doesn't get them around the EU copyright.
If they're
the only ones uploading stuff, they'd be just making sure that my stuff's not copyrighted by anyone else.
If I was in the EU, they still wouldn't be allowed,
some random noob to just start posting on their site.
Look, if I was in the EU now, I'd start really trying to find a group of people to do peer-to-peer. Post stuff on each other's boxes and stuff like that.
If I understood the article correctly, I basically couldn't do this show the way I do it today, because I read news articles and I post links to them. According to that, I would have to pay all of these news sites for advertising their sites for them, which is what we're really doing. I'm picking apart news articles and telling you where I'm getting them from. So, in the show notes, we have links to all of them. I do that to cover my butt, so you know where I'm pulling stuff from, so I'm not just making it up. But I literally cannot do this show in Europe now.
And in the U.S., what we're doing is legal.
Absolutely.
I could see one thing that some of these larger companies may do. YouTube is a U.S. company.
Just block EU.
They could just say, we're not subject to your law. And they don't have to block EU. It's the EU citizens who would be violating. And the way they wrote the law, not a violation for any EU citizen to see it. It's a violation for a company to post it. So they're just in an "you can't enforce the law that you wrote" situation.
I've got an amusing article like that near the end too. So
I'm just thinking, has this accidentally created the .com explosion in America for hosting?
The only downside to this is any member of Alphabet, like their CEOs, board members, they're not going to be taking European vacations anytime soon.
Yeah, they'd be arrested the moment they step foot. Well, Zuckerberg can't go to parts of Europe right now.
he's afraid.
Yeah.
So yeah,
if he lands, he won't get out.
Vacationing in the States and in Asia.
Wait, Kim.com can't go anywhere but New Zealand.
Cycros has a good point in the chat that Google doesn't want to forego all that business, especially with Android.
Look, I think Google are looking more towards China for their new customer base, and they've given them a big hard pass for Europe. Europe's just a convoluted mess of fucking rules, where at least with China, you know what you can and can't do straight away. That's why I think they'll go there for the next big market. They're not going to care about Europe.
Yeah, I think that's why that's why Britain made the smart move by getting. Oh, right, I forgot.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
We all know it's not going to happen. They're going to make them vote on it again and again until they get the answer they want. It's never going to actually happen.
We like to think the illusion of democracy, but hey, fuck it. I think they'll give Europe just a hard pass because it's just going to be too complicated.
Well, I mean, every time a large American company starts setting foot over there, the EU comes in, makes up a bunch of shit, and you know tries to take a couple $1 billion off of them.
Yeah, but didn't they go after Apple for a shit ton right now?
Yeah, they decided that Apple, despite working entirely with Ireland's government on this, was violating Irish law and therefore had to pay all these crazy-ass back taxes, even though they had agreements with the Irish government about it. Now, you might think that the agreements they had weren't fair, and they probably weren't because they basically weren't paying taxes. They were using it as a tax haven. So it's not a great thing, but they had an agreement with their government. It wasn't illegal.
That wasn't just an agreement with Apple. The U.S., our government, help Ireland set up that tax structure after World War II to help them suck businesses into Ireland. Any business could do that. It was not an Apple-only thing. Apple's just the biggest one to take advantage of it.
Well, I'm picking on them specifically because then the EU came in and said you had to pay, Jesus, it was millions that they had to pay in taxes. So, I mean, it was just, now granted for Apple, yeah, I guess that is just, you know, write them a check and make them go away, but it seems like they do that a lot in Europe. They seem to like changing the rules over there, but that's okay. We can pick on Europe, but I'm going to pick on Australia now. This is from abcnews.au and has a picture of some douche from Microsoft. There we go. There's your link. Microsoft says encryption laws make companies wary of storing data in Australia. Microsoft President Brad Smith has warned companies are no longer comfortable storing customer data in Australia after the introduction of controversial encryption laws. Mr. Smith told a Canberra audience that the laws are too vague and are damaging the Australian technology industry and broader economy as businesses raise concerns about privacy and look to overseas markets. When I travel to other countries, I hear companies and governments say we are no longer comfortable putting our data in Australia. So they are asking us to build more data centers in other countries, Mr. Smith said. Late last year, with the support of the opposition, the coalition passed laws to give intelligence agencies greater access to encrypted messages sent by suspected criminals. In some cases, these security agencies can demand companies build new capabilities to allow them to read the otherwise hidden messages. The federal government argues that these laws are crucial to combating terrorism and serious crime, but the technology industry has described them as an overreach that will hurt the industry and undermine privacy. Mr. Smith said Australia had developed a reputation as a destination for companies to store customer data, although that has been undermined in the past 6 months. We will have to sort through those issues, but if I were an Australian who wanted to advance the Australian technology economy, I would want to address that and put the minds of others like-minded governments at ease, he said. It has not changed to date anything that we have had to do in Australia, but we do worry about some areas of the law in terms of potential consequences. Mr. Smith said he did not believe the law intended to create a so-called backdoor that would undermine encryption technology, but described the legislation as vague. There's this wonderful phrase about enabling companies to avoid creating systemic weakness, but that phrase is not defined, he said. Until it is defined, I think people will worry, and we will be among those who will worry because we do feel it's vitally important for we protect our customers' privacy. Mr. Smith said it was in the interest of the Australian government to ease concerns about the legislation or to amend it. The Australian technology industry has this week renewed its calls for the laws to be amended before the election, arguing there should be more oversight and reduction in scope. The Australian Signals Directorate has rejected claims the laws give security agencies unfettered power or that technology companies will be forced overseas. Agencies in the UK have already have similar powers, and other nations are considering their options. The claims legislation will drive technology companies offshore are similarly flawed. So I guess that was their response.
Look, I think the simplest thing to say in this is that our government made a serious mistake by actively publishing that they were doing this. Because every other fucking nation does it. Like, with CIA, it's just a fucking wink and a nod with Apple and those guys.
No, they usually get an NSL, and, you know, it's like, yeah, if you tell anybody we're making you do this, you know, we'll cut your nuts off.
Well, that's what I mean. Our government just made it transparent.
It's not a wink and a nod, more as, you know, tying you down to the table and putting the knife between your legs, but...
I was just being... facetious about it.
Is the law requiring like a back door into encryption, or what does the law itself do?
Yeah, back door into everything.
Basically, it says, if I understood it right, the Australian government, or well, their agencies, can request a back door be created. It doesn't necessarily mandate that there be one now, but if they ask for one, you have to build one.
Because right now, the FBI and the CIA can't force changes. Now, they can ask for you to try to break the encryption, but if you say you can't, it ends there. Well, it ends there as far as you cracking it. They'll take you to court and have you try to prove that you can't crack it. But we haven't actually forced a back door yet.
I don't think it's as big a story as it's made out, but... I don't think they should have. Look, there is a place for this style of surveillance.
Oh, we're getting ready to talk about that place next. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's called China. But the issue is still going to be.
Oh, not in this case, but okay.
If you can break the encryption, then it's not encrypted.
Well, that's not true.
Well, it's not talk to you. If you put a backdoor in encryption, the cops aren't going to be the only ones with that backdoor. So if you put a backdoor in a bank's encryption, you're saying, I want to make it possible to rob this bank. That might not be what you want to say, but those are the words coming out of your mouth.
We should talk after the show. I have a fantastic paper I've written, and I can't submit it anywhere. Anyways, it's all internal shit, right? And I'm proud of it too, and I can't do shit with it. good old proprietary technology and confidentiality agreements, right? But yeah, it's so you are correct in that the intention is that nobody can decrypt it except the intended owner, recipient, whatever. But there's technically encrypted and usefully encrypted, and those are not the same thing.
I will concede not all encryption is created equal.
So, as a fun example, let's say you're running a file server for a company, and that file server, you turn on encryption. Everything written to disk is encrypted. From a technical level, it's encrypted. From a functional level, it's useless, because that's only useful if somebody breaks into your data center and steals the physical file server. And that's not very common, especially because for the most part, they're big and heavy because, you know, they're full of disks. Now, some of the newer ones that are based on like flash disks, they're smaller, but they're still kind of heavy. So it's like, that's technically encrypted, but also functionally useless because everything that's going to access that file server, the file server is just going to decrypt it, because that's how you set it up so that it actually has use. So I may have gotten into an argument with some people over what the auditors are going to say. So not bitter.
It's all encrypted. Everyone that wants to access it can still access it, but it's all encrypted.
It's like those books.
I'm imagining the argument right now.
It's like those books you used to get as a kid that had the red splotches printed all over something, and you'd use a little red magnifying glass to look at it and see whatever was printed in blue through the red.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's basically what some forms of encryption are. Technically encrypted, or at least obscured, functionally useless. Because anybody can get a red lens and see it, or just, you know, squint. So, anyways.
Well, I'm not going to say people can't put out a bad product. I'm just not going to buy it. I will say I don't want the government to mandate all the products be crap.
Well, the real problem is that the law is new and really untested. If they ever get some court law around it to clarify what can actually be requested and not, you'll either see people calm the hell down or all of the data centers immediately vacate Australia.
And that's the crappy part about this law. When a law is written, its intent should be clear in the law. You don't have a judge reinterpret what you write. So if it is wide open that they can ask you to put a back door on anything, that's the intent of the law. That's what the government can do.
Well, and that's just it, because the thing doesn't really make it clear, because they have some lines in it that say that we can't make an onerous burden, and other lines that say we can request you to modify products.
And it doesn't define what onerous burden is.
Or what the modification of the products is, from my understanding. Yeah. So it's just like...
I wonder. Yeah. It's vague.
It, again, this is the same problem we have with the EU law. The people who wrote it don't understand what they wrote. They're asking for unicorns, and they don't realize it. And they think people... It's because Hollywood depicts anything with technology as a substitution for wizardry. It's like, oh, well, look at him type quickly and make out code. He's a wizard. He can make the computer do anything. No, it doesn't actually work that way. There are limitations to what you can do with this shit. I realize that everybody selling an AI algorithm right now is telling you that Watson can solve everything, or Siri can answer all your needs, or Alexa can order, you know, cat food for you. For anybody who's listening to this on speakers, Alexa, order a pallet of toilet paper. Confirm. Or what was the one? Alexa, put the biggest, blackest dildo you can find in the shopping cart. Order. Confirm. I don't know why anybody has those things in their house. They're the dumbest fucking idea.
Deary, what's a whopper?
Although, if you're bored sometime, ask Siri why a fire truck is red. Anyways,
I used to ask him how to have a body. No one answers me anymore.
I'm pretty sure it's not going to be too much longer before the police come up and say, if people ask Siri how to hide a body, can you just have their phone immediately notify the police? Yeah, they did take most of the jokes out of it, unfortunately. But the Samsung one will still rap. So, anyways. Let's see. Torrent Freak. Russia orders major VPN providers to block banned sites. Sort of defeating the point of a VPN.
Yes, sir. We will do that immediately.
Fuck this bitch. This is Russia. Anyways, Russia, I already read the headline. 10 major VPN providers have been ordered by Russian authorities to begin blocking sites present in the country's national block lists. NordVPN, ExpressVPN, IPVanish, and HideMyAss are among those affected. Torgard also received a notification and has pulled its services out of Russia with immediate effect. Well, good on Torgard for taking the right action.
Yeah, well done.
For the past several years, Russia has continued with its mission to restrict access to content the state finds objectionable. Many kinds of sites, from alleged pirate platforms to sites hosting extremist content, have all been affected. Local ISPs are required by law to block their domains, rendering them inaccessible. However, plenty of circumvention options are available, something the government is trying to address. In July, or during July of 2017, President Vladimir Putin signed a bill into law aiming to close this loophole. The plan was to prevent citizens from accessing banned sites using VPNs, proxies, Tor, and other anonymizing services. The threat was simple. If such services were found to be facilitating access to banned platforms, they too could find themselves on Russia's internet blacklist, known locally as FGIS. While some VPN providers pulled out of Russia well before the new legislation, private internet access exited in 2016 for unconnected reasons, others have continued. Now, however, authorities are attempting to tighten the noose. During the past few days, Telecoms Watch Roskomnadzor said it sent its... That name screwed me up. Says it sent compliance notifications to 10 major VPN services with servers inside Russia. NordVPN, ExpressVPN, TorGuard, IPVanish, VPN Unlimited, ViperVPN, Kaspersky Secure Connection, HideMyAss, HolaVPN, and OpenVPN. Wait, OpenVPN? That's not really a...
No,
that's
not.
Just an open source platform. Anyways, the government agency is demanding that the affected services begin interfacing with the FGIS database, blocking sites listed within. Several other local companies, Search Giant Yandex, Sputnik, Mail.ru, and Rambler, are already connected to the database and filtering as required. In accordance with paragraph 5, article 15.8 of federal law number 149FZ of 27.07.2006 on information technology and the protection of information, hereby we are informing you of... Man, that sounds like something out of a bad movie where they like start quoting regulations without having to look them up. They do that in Star Trek a lot too, now that I think about it. They just like start quoting some random ass regulation without having to look it up. It's like bullshit. Nobody has this stuff memorized. On information technology and protection of information, hereby we are informing you about the necessity to get connected to the federal state information system of the blocked information sources and networks, FGIS, within 30 working days from the receipt of this notice. A notice received by TorGuard reveals that the provider was indeed given just under a month to comply. The notice also details the consequences for not doing so, being placed on the blacklist with the rest of the banned site so it cannot operate in Russia. TorGuard, however, is clear. It won't operate under those terms, so it has already left of its own accord. At the time of this writing, TorGuard has taken steps to remove all physical server presence from Russia. We have wiped clean all servers in our St. Petersburg and Moscow locations and will no longer be doing business with data centers in the region, the company said in a statement. We would like to be clear that this removal of servers was a voluntary decision by TorGuard management and no equipment seizure occurred. The demand from Roskomnadzor's sent to TorGuard and other companies also requires that they—I'm sure I'm saying that name wrong—also requires that they hand over information to the authorities, including details of their operations and places of business. The notice, anything we can use to prosecute you, you will give us. The notice itself states that for foreign entities, Russian authorities require the full entity name, country of residence, tax number, and or trade registration number, postal and email address details, plus other information. The notification provided by TorGuard doesn't make any demands to access VPN customer data. However, given TorGuard's privacy policies, that should already be a moot point. We do not store any logs, so even if the servers were compromised, it would be impossible for customer data to be exposed, the provider added. In the same situation, it could be true at several other VPN providers contracted by Russian authorities, NordVPN, ExpressVPN, TorGuard, and ViperVPN, for example, all declared in Torrent Freak's 2009 annual roundup that they carry zero logs. As the companies in question consult their legal teams, only time will tell which of the others will choose to comply with Russian law and begin blocking or leave the region completely. I think they all need to leave the region completely. Make them understand that those kind of laws are kind of antithetical to the idea of running a VPN.
Doesn't Britain's porn pass come in soon as well?
Yeah, I think so.
You're going to have a license to have a wank.
I can just see now a British Bobby breaks into your house, points the nightstick at you. Oi, oi, do you have a license to touch that dick?
I wonder if Poland can get an uplift from this. Because they want servers kind of in that area to service those customers. So just move them to Poland. Like, you're now our eastern hub.
Maybe. I mean, they don't really say what they're doing. It's just that, you know, the one is pulling out. So it's kind of sad to see them start locking down on every service like this, but it's going to be a cat and mouse game, right? It's like, oh, well, they're locking down our VPN providers. Well, fine, I'm going to go with this other VPN provider, or I'm going to go with Tor, which good luck. Or I'm going to go with, you know, good Lord, one of the other dark nets. There's plenty of those floating around, Freenet or what's the other I can't think of it. Oh well. Anyways,
off the top of my head, like, same, man.
Yeah. No. There's also like various anonymizer services that do shit, and plus new, you know, other peer to peer protocols. Or hell, it's just, you know, what are you going to do about somebody spinning up little private VPN servers between their friends? You know, I mean, if I was to run a little VPN service out of my house and let RU hit it to, you know, get to some of the banned websites, I mean, one, how are they even going to know? But two, what's going to happen?
I think someone raised that with me, I think 48 hours into it, and I just flat out said no. I said, thanks for the offer, but I don't want to compromise you. You know, it's, we don't know what's going to happen. And there are extradition laws from Australia to...
they're not going to extradite me for practicing my First Amendment rights.
Yeah, it's not illegal in the States.
No. There are some things that we will actually fight extradition on.
Yeah, I'd rather not figure out how this all works, so I'd rather just go no, but thanks for the offer.
What would suck is if your country decided to shit on us, we couldn't vacation there.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. I don't want any border hassles.
Well, at least with their government knowing. I mean, we could, you know, the speedboat idea is still a thing.
Still a thing. Bring me some of that fresh internet over my boat.
So, let's see.
Ooh. Your latency would suck, but the packet sizes would be huge. I could just start dropping SD cards in the mail and sending them to you.
So the way you met, and the funny thing is, it's come up in the past that technically FedExing a hard drive full of data usually is considered higher bandwidth than most fiber links. It's just, you know, the latency sucks. It's like 8 terabyte hard drive full of stuff, you know, shipped via overnight is usually considered better bandwidth because you're getting the full data faster than, you know, sending it over a fiber link.
Last person to come out here, I ended up with, I think it was 4 terabytes worth of data.
Yeah, but that's been a bit. Disks have gotten bigger since then.
Oh yeah, when I go back next year, man, I'll be coming back with at least 10 terabits of stuff.
So yeah.
Yeah, just I'm a big advocate for storing heaps and heaps of shit just in case they turn it off, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Oh, they'd look at me weird if I brought my DVD collection down under with me.
I'm going to have to mail you a hard drive there, madman.
No, you misunderstand. It's an actual DVD collection. About 10 years ago, I showed him how to copy Netflix discs. He went nuts.
Yeah, I bought spindles of DVDs. I was backing up one of their warehouses.
Yeah, I've got God knows how much music, man. I mean, and shit I wouldn't even listen to. Just because I could.
I need to go through. I have stacks of old CDRs and DVDRs, like in books and just spindles full of them over in the corner on the shelf over there. I need to sit down and go through them because I'm sure I can probably throw, I can probably throw all the discs away, but there's only probably, you know, a couple hundred gigs of stuff that I actually would want to copy off onto my file server. So, well,
everything that I've pirated is actually something that I would want. And often I actually bought legit copies of it. The only stuff that I wouldn't swipe was stuff that was given to me, like legit copies. Like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I would have never bought it. The movie? Books are good. The movie's okay.
Yeah. I think there's a story related to that movie, but it's very regional, so I don't really want to go into it. Let's see. Next article is from Ars Technica, and it's Office Depot sinking to the level of the Indian, you know, Microsoft scammers. Office Depot rigged PC malware scans to sell unneeded $300 tech support. Office Depot and a partner company tricked customers into buying unneeded tech support services by offering PC scans that gave fake results. According to the Federal Trade Commission, consumers paid up to $300 each for unnecessary services. The FTC yesterday announced that Office Depot and its software supplier support.com have agreed to pay a total of $35 million in settlements with the agency. Not to the people they scammed, to the government. Office Depot agreed to pay $25 million, while support.com will pay the other $10. FTC said it intends to use the money to provide refunds to wronged customers, so you have to go to the FTC and prove that you were wronged. Between 2009 and 2016, Office Depot and Office Max offered computer scans inside their stores using a PC health check software application created and licensed by support.com. Defendants bilked unsuspecting customers out of tens of millions of dollars from their use of the PC Health Check program to sell costly diagnostic and repair services. The FTC alleged in a complaint that accuses both companies of violating the FTC Act's prohibition against deceptive practices. As part of the settlements, neither company admitted nor denied the FTC's allegations. The FTC filed its complaint against companies in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida, while at the same time unveiling the settlements with each company. KIRO7 in Seattle aired an expose of the practice in November of 2016. The news station found that Office Depot stores claimed to find infections on brand new computers that had never even been connected to the internet. Well, with China-manufactured stuff, that may not be unfair.
If it's a Huawei, you may want to check it.
Yeah, the British government's going nuts right now because they found a bunch of vulnerabilities in Huawei stuff, which is not actually all that surprising because Huawei just, you know, got their hands on a bunch of old Cisco code, and that was the basis for a lot of their stuff. So they could just be finding vulnerabilities that Cisco fixed years ago. But right now, the EU's government is just going absolutely nuts because they found 70-some-odd vulnerabilities in Huawei gear. Let's see. The stores offered PC health check scans for free, while claiming the value of the scans was between $20 and $60.
Wow.
Really?
Dude, just walk in and punch him in the dick.
$20 to $60 for the scan. Malwarebytes is just giving it away. I mean, come on, guys. I guess would that make Malwarebytes and AVG and Avast the sluts of the AV industry? Because they just, I mean...
Big. Giving it away for
just
free?
Giving it away.
God damn.
But PC Health Check was configured to tell customers their computers were infected regardless of what any scan showed, according to the FTC. At the beginning of each scan, consumers were asked if they experienced PC problems, such as repeated crashes or slowness. Any yes answer in that survey guaranteed the program would flag a problem with the user's computer. While Office Depot claimed the program detected malware symptoms on customers' computers, the actual results presented to customers were based entirely on whether consumers answered yes to the four questions they were asked at the beginning of the PC Health Check program, the FTC said. These included questions about whether the computer ran slow, received virus warnings, crashed often, or displayed pop-up ads or other problems that prevented the users from browsing the internet. In other words, if you had ever been to any website with ads ever. obviously, a PC user who brings a computer to a store for a malware scan is likely to suspect there's a problem, and thus likely to check one of the boxes. If a box was checked, the software falsely told consumers that the PC scans found malware symptoms or infections, even if the computers were fine, according to the FTC. The PC health check tricked consumers into thinking their computers had symptoms of malware or actual infections, even though the scans hadn't found any of such issues. The FTC said in a blog post, many consumers who got false scan results bought computer diagnostic and repair services from Office Depot and Office Max that cost up to $300. Support.com completed the services and got a cut of each purchase. Office Depot and Office Max merged in 2013. Before the merger, both were using support.com, which provided cloud-based software and technical support services directly to consumers and indirectly through clients such as office supply retail stores, the FTC said. Office Depot tech experts, which they have in quotes because that's usually kids out of high school who know how to type, told customers that PC Health Check would optimize their computers. But in reality, the software did not complete diagnostics on consumers' computers, the FTC said. Some later versions of the software did some limited optimizations, such as removing junk files and reconfiguring certain settings. So they ran CCleaner? After displaying fake scan results to consumers who had checked off any of the four boxes, PC Health Check would also display a view recommendation button, which detailed descriptions of the tech services consumers were encouraged to purchase, services that could cost hundreds of dollars to fix the problems. In some cases, store employees checked the boxes themselves, guaranteeing that the software would produce a warning, the FTC complaint said. Defendants trained Office Depot and Office Max store employees on how to utilize the PC Health Check program and instructed store employees to check any of the initial checkbox statements that applied based on the customer's or consumer's responses, the complaint said. Consistent with their training, Office Depot and Office Max store employees read each of the initial checkbox statements once the program began and selected the corresponding box based on the consumer's response. So anything other than an emphatic no, no, no pounding the table, they were going to check the box.
I want to know who blew the whistle on this. Was it an employee who just went, this is fucking wrong?
Probably.
But how did they find out? Yeah. Like, the fact that this went on for so long, I believe that any employee who knew what was going on and had a little shits and giggles in the fucking break room about it, maybe should be subject to some sort of fine as well. Because you're complicit in the fraud here.
Well, if you talk to anybody who's ever worked for, you know, what is it, Best Buy, the Geek Squad or these tech support services for the retail stores, 90% of the time they just format the machine, reinstall Windows, and call it a day, right?
Yeah.
And they all had, you know, at least the people I've talked to, they all had their own flash drives and external drives, and they would go through these PCs for music, movies, games, nudes, dick pics, whatever the hell they wanted. And if they saw something they liked, they'd copy it off and then, you know, format the machine and get rid of the viruses, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, honestly, taking your machine to any of these places already was like a bad idea because you're going to charge you $60 to run programs that you could run for free. Or, you know, just format your computer, which, again, you could do for yourself for free. Because every PC you bought came with a restore disk for the longest time. Now it's a partition on the hard drive, but whatever. So, let's see. The article keeps going on here. Does it have anything about how they caught it?
Yeah, that's all I wonder.
Yeah, apparently they changed the programs because the employees push the scan. Yeah, here we go. Employees who pushed the scans got positive performance reviews and extra commissions if they met their weekly PC health check runs and tech support service sales goals, the FTC said. At the same time, Office Depot companies censured store managers and store employees who continually failed to meet these company-wide targets. Stores that failed to meet their targets were subjected to underperforming calls with the store's managers that reproached the store's performance. So in other words,
wow,
yeah, they were saying, oh, you weren't pushing enough fake repair shit. You're going to be, they'd fire them or they'd give them a bonus for running it enough. When Office Depot sought additional revenue, it instructed its stores collectively to raise millions of dollars in profit by increasing the number of PC health check services performed and the rate of converting the PC health check services into tech support service sales, the FTC said. That's kind of fucked, right? It's like, no, you have to convert these things into tech support sales. I.e., it doesn't matter whether, you know, who cares if there's something to actually fix? We need the sales. Which I guess is the whole basis of the FTC complaint, but still. So, in November 2016, Office Depot suspended its use of the PC Health Check service after KIRO7, I guess it's a radio station, aired a series of investigative reports about the tech service divisions of Office Depot stores in Washington and Oregon that were flagging malware or malware symptoms on computers that were, unbeknownst to the stores, brand new straight out of the box, the FTC said. So somebody did an old school undercover report. They just took some machines they knew were clean, took them in to see what they said. They did the whole, you know, the exact same shit that people used to do to, like, auto repair places that were scamming people, or the mattress salesman who was, you know, stuffing the mattresses with, you know, garbage and shit. So let's see. But nobody's done that shit since the 90s, so that's interesting.
No, man, you're wrong.
They still do it?
A couple of years ago, people were getting third-degree burns from couches that they were buying out of China.
How do you get a third-degree burn off a couch?
They claimed that it was real leather, but it wasn't real leather. It was something else that was treated with a highly caustic chemical to give it the feel of real leather.
So, a third-degree chemical burn...
Burn. Yeah.
I was going to say, you're not supposed to light the couch on fire. That's not a feature. I mean.
So, yeah, there are douchebag stuff still going on in retail.
Oh, yeah, of course. But, no, I meant the people doing the investigative or undercover reporting on this stuff.
Well, if there's no Russians under the couch, I don't think they care.
Yeah, that's for sure. I was going to say, I used to love seeing those old reports where, like, they put the hidden camera in the car and take it to the mechanic. And then they had their own mechanics who certified there was nothing wrong with the car. And then the mechanic would come back and be like, oh, yeah, you need a new engine. You know?
John Stossel's still kicking about on YouTube, man. He's got a channel.
He is, but he doesn't do that stuff as much. He's mostly doing politics right now.
Politics,
but he was one of the better ones.
The problem with doing that anymore is a lot of states have put in consent laws for taping. So it can only be done in a single-party consent state. And then you have legal issues broadcasting it nationwide. Crowder ran into that whenever he hit up some stuff in Texas. His state would allow it, so they sued him in California.
Gotcha. Oh, yeah, he did have a reporter he talked to on the phone at the end of the interview by saying, you do know that Texas is a single-party consent state, right? What? Click. was hilarious. Let's see. Instead of providing assurances that Office Depot wouldn't continue the practice, the senior manager at the Office Depot company, primarily responsible for the procuring tech support vendors, testified under oath that it would be proper for the company to continue to continue offering the same PC health check to consumers even after the KIRO 7 news report, the FTC said. That's balls. Office Depot finally severed its relationship with Support.com in 2017, but the office chain bought another tech support company and is continuing to offer computer diagnostic services and sell computer repair services. The FTC said in a statement, prohibits Office Depot from making misrepresentations about the security or performance of consumers' electronic devices and requires the company to ensure its existing and future software providers do not engage in such conduct. The settlement requires Office Depot to submit to compliance monitoring. Support.com faces similar provisions in its settlement with the FTC. So, yeah... I mean, that's pretty fucked.
That's one reason I don't trust chain retailers to work on computers. I go to Bob's Repair Shop, where Bob's fat and wears glasses and can answer 4 gaming questions.
Look, I know we wear glasses and I'm fat, but why do you have to insult me by calling me Bob?
It's going with Bob's Repair Shop. It's in town. You're too far away to fix my computer.
Yeah. Next article is from The Atlantic, and it's hilarious, and kind of an easy one to predict. Airbnb has a hidden camera problem.
Called it.
When Max Vest shook hands with the host of his Miami Airbnb back in January, the man introduced himself as Ralph, even though Ray was the name he used in all prior communication. This is the first and only indication that something was wrong, but his host had a great rating on the home sharing site. Many of the comments mentioned how friendly and accommodating he was. So Vest, a children's camp director from Gainesville, Florida, didn't think much of this discrepancy and settled into the two-bedroom, two-bathroom apartment he'd be sharing with Ralph, or was it Ray, and his girlfriend for the next 5 days. At about 8 or 9 p.m., he went out for dinner, and by the time he got home, his host had gone to bed in the room adjacent to his, and he prepared to do the same. That's when he saw the light. Two small, black, rectangular boxes were stacked next to an outlet on the far side of the guest room, both facing the bed. From afar, they looked like phone chargers, but when Vest got closer, he realized they were cameras and they were recording. He quickly got dressed, grabbed his belongings, and pocketed the camera's memory cards as evidence. Then panic set in. It was almost midnight, and he was alone in the home of someone whose name he didn't even know, apparently being recorded. And what's more, he could have lost. His host could have been watching as he discovered the cameras. "I didn't know if I was being watched live," Vest told me in January. "What I've found since is that the cameras record to a memory card, but that they can also stream live. The host could have been watching. Anybody could have been watching." The company denied the Atlantic and Vest's request for Ralph's full name identity, citing its privacy policy. Vest was afraid of what might happen if Ralph saw him leave. "I know that he had at stake by being caught," Vest said. He managed to leave the apartment without incident, get in his car, make two phone calls, one to his wife and one to Airbnb's safety team. The company refunded Vest money, paid for a hotel room for the night, and eventually removed the host from the site. But Vest alleges that Airbnb made several missteps in the run-up to and subsequent investigation of his stay with Ralph. He has retained counsel and informed Airbnb that he is considering filing a civil suit against it under Florida's Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act. He says the company should have flagged his host sooner for the name discrepancy and the fact that he did not have his landlord's permission to rent out the property. Well, okay, yeah, that's kind of which is in violation of Airbnb's terms of service. He also alleges that Airbnb mistreated him during his investigation and that it should have done more to support him as he reached out to law enforcement. A rare representative for Airbnb declined to comment on the specifics of Vest's allegations. Well, if it's going to court, that makes sense. In emails reviewed by The Atlantic, Airbnb told Vest that the company is taking his case extremely seriously and that guest safety is its top priority. But Vest says he feels Airbnb treated him as a frustrated guest when he feels he was a victim of a crime. "This wasn't just a negative experience," he said. "This was a criminal act." Airbnb's rules allow cameras outdoors and in living rooms and common areas, but never in bathrooms or anywhere guests plan to sleep, including rooms with fold-out beds. Starting in early 2018, Airbnb added another layer of disclosure. If hosts indicate they have cameras anywhere on the property, guests receive a pop-up informing them where the cameras are located and where they are aimed. To book a property, guests must click agree, indicating that they're aware of the cameras and consent to being filmed. Of course, hosts have plenty of reasons to train cameras on the homes they rent out to strangers. They can catch guests who attempt to steal or who trash a place or initially say they're traveling alone and then show up to the property with five people. A representative for Airbnb's Trust and Safety Communications Department told me the company tries to filter out hosts who may attempt to surveil guests by matching them against sex offenders and felony databases. The company also uses risk scores to flag suspicious behavior in addition to reviewing and booting hosts with consistently poor scores. If a guest contacts Airbnb's trust and safety team with a complaint about a camera, employees offer new accommodations if necessary and open an investigation on the host. In a statement, Airbnb representative said, "The safety of our community, both online and offline, is our priority, which is why we take reports of privacy violations very seriously and employ sophisticated technologies to help prevent bad actors from using our platform in the first place."
Didn't we do this story last week?
I don't think so.
Because you went and bought a hidden camera.
Yeah, but we were talking about something else, and that's, and I did get that thing, and dude, you can't tell it's a fucking camera. I took it to work and passed it around and told them it was a hidden camera, and they couldn't figure out where the lens was.
Oh.
So, ooh, I like, so the rest of the story is complaining about this, and but I like Cycros' idea. Prove the host put the camera there.
Yeah.
If it's just like hidden cams to regular hotels or in public locker rooms, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could honestly see if you're doing Airbnb that you would probably want some form of surveillance to make sure that if a guest trashes the place, you can go back to Airbnb and say, hey. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, anymore, if you just go look on Amazon, you can find so many hidden cameras that you would never see. Like I said, I ordered one that looked like a phone charger. And, dude, I mean, you can't tell. You have to catch it in the light just ever so perfectly to see the little transparent part where the lens goes. Now, I haven't really played with it yet, but it's interesting. Because it's just like every phone charger you see could be a camera now. The only indication that there's anything off with it is that it's a little bit longer than you would expect a phone charger to be. But, dude, I mean, you know, those things are in so many different shapes and sizes, I don't know how you'd really tell. Unless you go around prying
everything. I've got an older model phone charger.
Yeah.
They were a little bigger at one point.
Yeah. So it's like, what do? Just pull apart everything that looks like it could have... anything that looks like it'd have a camera, take it apart. If it has wires coming out of it, cut it. Take apart your intercom, just cut all the wires. You know, just make sure they're not listening to you. a joke I rejected for opening the show. I just now remembered. you, listening on the bus, look around. Everyone you see with the Apple earbuds in, whether the wireless ones or not, the ones looking at their phones right now, they're getting instructions. They're watching you. They're filing reports. Get off the bus. Run. Now, to everybody else laughing at the guy who got off the bus running, he was the one who had the right idea.
Authorized by the Department of Home Repairs. We're not after your dick pics.
I don't know. My favorite version of that joke, I heard several years ago, 3 a.m. on my way back from Florida, we live in your radio, and yes, we can see you. That's not something to hear at 3 a.m. after not sleeping.
Start eyeballing the speakers really suspiciously.
Like, fuck, I knew you little people existed.
Let's see. Last article I have for tonight is from Ars Technica. And is just, I mean, predictable. G15 talked to me once late at night. Well, and it was RU. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say that we don't occasionally hop on the stream randomly and do shit. Especially when
I haven't done that
listeners.
In years. Well, I haven't done that in years.
We haven't had it set up so that anybody but me can take over the broadcast for a long time either. We used to have it set up so that different people could hop onto the box and take over. But since Decking's the only show that's still running live, it's like, yeah, 8 years ago. Yeah, we would have done it then. Because I had set it up so that a lot of people could get in and take over the stream whenever they wanted. And that setup is no longer the case anymore. Pretty much it's just Decking. So let's see. But this article is hilarious. It's from Ars Technica. The FCC fined robocallers $208 million since 2015, but it's only collected $6,790. The Federal Communications Commission has issued $208.4 million in fines against robocallers since 2015, but the commission has only collected $6,790 of that amount. That's because the FCC lacks the authority to enforce the penalties, according to the investigation by the Wall Street Journal. So in other words, the FCC is trying to levy fines and people are just saying, fuck you.
Enforce it.
The Journal learned of the 6,790 figure by making a Freedom of Information Act request. An FCC spokesman said his agency lacked the authority to enforce the forfeiture orders it issues and has passed all unpaid penalties to the Justice Department, which does have the power to collect the fines, the Journal reports. Many of the spoofers and robocaller agencies the robocallers the agency tries to punish are individuals and small operations, the spokesman added, which means they are at times unable to pay the full penalties. The Justice Department declined to comment. Since Ajit Pai became FCC chairman in January 2017, the FCC has issued $202 million in forfeiture orders against robocallers, but has collected none of it, the journal wrote. It indicates that a $120 million penalty issued in May of 2018 against a robocaller that was accused of making 96 million robocalls during the first three-month period in order to trick people into buying vacation homes. Separately, the FTC has collected $121 million out of $1.5 billion worth of penalties issued against robocallers since 2004, the journal reports. An FTC spokesperson told the journal that it's proud of its 8% collection rate.
This is, of course, a picture of former President Ronald Reagan naturally firing a machine gun while riding on the back of a dinosaur.
That just felt appropriate for some reason. I don't really know why. The dearth of financial penalties collected by the U.S. government for violations of telemarketing and auto-dialing rules shows that the limits of the sister regulators, the FCC and the FTC, face in putting a stop to illegal robocalls, the journal wrote. It also shows why the threat of large fines can fail to deter bad actors. Fines can be a deterrent on legitimate companies that have real assets in the United States, but they aren't as effective against scammers and overseas operations, an attorney quoted by the journal said. Paid FCC fines are deposited in the U.S. Treasury. In some cases, the FCC settles with offenders, such settlements can include refunds for customers or compliance requirements. The FCC's enforcement process begins with the issuance of a proposed fine. The first formal step informs the company of the alleged unlawful activity, establishes the maximum penalty that they could be assessed for the violation, and provides the company with an opportunity to contest the allegations, the FCC said. The FCC's best bet for collecting is often settling with a violator for some amount lower than the proposed fine. If there is no settlement, the FCC can issue the aforementioned forfeiture order and hope that the violators pay up. Hope. Yeah. How are you running your agency? On hope, spit, and duct tape. In 2008, the $208.4 million figure of the journals in the journal story consists of forfeiture orders in cases involving robocalling, the do not call registry, and telephone solicitation violations. So, I don't really need, you know, the rest of the article goes into more detail about some of the things they have been able to do, but it's just like, no shit, you can't collect on these scams. They fold up shop and disappear the moment you send them a letter, and most of them are overseas anyways.
I was about to ask, what percentage of them are actually in the jurisdiction of the U.S.?
It's pretty small.
I'm thinking a big percentage of them aren't.
Most of them aren't, at least the actual call centers. The company setting them up might be. Because a lot of times what happens is you'll have somebody or a group of people who set up the scam, and then they contract, like, you know, Indian telemarketer companies, to go with the stereotype. Because a lot of times the guy's calling you up saying they work for Microsoft, they're reading a script, right? They work for a legitimate call center. The call center just doesn't bother to verify that their script makes sense for the person contracting them. Because that's probably normal for them to say they're representing such and such company, because in legitimate cases, you probably want them saying that anyways, because if they're a contractor for that company, they are, in fact, representing that company. So, you know, it's just somebody's telling them, hey, you're representing Microsoft, say this, and argue with them. Of course, you have to think most of them know it's a scam. I guess they just don't care. So,
well, they've streamlined it now. Now they're using a pre-scripted call that auto-dials you, and it prompts you to press 1. And when you press 1, the machine just rings the phone of which telemarketer is not on a call right then. So it takes the Indian dude out of being abused straight away. You actually have to press 1 to abuse a poo.
Yeah, you do. They just hang up on me right nowadays, though, instead of arguing with me. I'm a little disappointed about that, truth be told. Used to be, you sit there, argue with them, abuse them, call them all kinds of names, get them really, really upset. You cannot say these things to me. You cannot say these things. You called me asshole. But, yeah, anymore now, they just hang up on you.
How do you like your steak, sir? I prefer mine medium.
So, although, what was it? Was it called Pat? I forget what the bot was called. That would you could forward the telemarketers to, and it would just sit there and respond to them with like nonsense, like it was a confused old man.
Oh, Larry.
Yeah.
Was it Larry?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an old Southern gentleman.
My favorite trick to pull was always just putting the three disconnect tones at the top of your voicemail. That tend to start weeding them out. Of course, then you have to explain to your parents what those tones are and why you put it in there. So it's like, why do I always have to hear that ear piercing thing whenever I call you? It's like, because I don't want to talk to you, and you end up hitting the voicemail, and it doesn't work for a person. Anyways, button. Are we done with this?
Yeah, I am. All
right. Got a couple of things for you in Digital Dojo tonight. The first is an interesting... I thought this thing was open source. It's not. Oh, well, never mind. So, two things for you tonight in Digital Dojo. That's what I get for not being more thorough with my checks, right? The first is an interesting write-up from nullprogram.com. This is about a SSH tar pit called Endless. And, of course, you've got the link to the GitHub project page. But basically what this thing does is it opens up a socket and pretends to be an SSH server. And it then just ties up the SSH client indefinitely. So, in other words, it accepts the connection and then just throws weights at it. And the idea is to just fuck with the scripts that are doing the SSH polling so that they never get anywhere. It's a tar pit. It's similar to other things that just sit there and screw with scanners. But it's the write up is by the guy who put it together. But it's just an interesting concept. I think it's funny, and SSH bots are still a thing. So here's the description from the GitHub page. Endless is an SSH tar pit that very slowly responds or sends an endless random SSH banner. It keeps the SSH clients locked up for hours or even days at a time. The purpose is to put your real SSH server on another port and then let the script kiddies get stuck in the tar pit instead of bothering a real server. Since the tar pit is in the banner before any cryptographic exchange occurs, this program doesn't depend on any cryptographic libraries. It's a simple, single-threaded, standalone C program. It uses poll to trap multiple clients at a time. And so, yeah, it's sending the SSH banner, like, one character at a time and, like, waiting as long as it possibly can before sending that character so the connection doesn't time out. It's literally just fucking with anybody trying to run SSH bots or password brooders or whatever. I love it. I think this stuff's great. And then the final thing I have for Digital Dojo tonight that RU sent me, it's zerobin.net. And this thing's interesting. It's pastebin, but it's encrypting whatever you send in. It's using JavaScript to do the encryption, which it even in their own FAQ, they admit is not secure on the client side because it's depending on the browser to do the JavaScript execution. But the way they've got it set up, the key is never actually sent to the host. The whole thing's encrypted in AES 256. And the idea is that if you don't have the generated link with the encryption key attached, you can't decrypt it. And their JavaScript and their pages do not send that key to the server. So the server has no clue what they're hosting. The upshot is that you can privately communicate with the groups of people by sending them these zerobin.net posts. and putting expiration time on them, so they're only good for so long. You know, they've got options on here from a day to a month and then never. And it's even got one that's called burn after reading. So the first time the page loads, it disappears. So if you're wanting for a secure way to send people stuff, this is a pretty interesting option. And if you don't have the URL with the decryption with a key in it, you're not going to get anything but garbage when you load the page. And they claim they never send, I have not audited the code, but it is open source and on GitHub, so you could audit the code and see if their promise about never sending the key back to themselves is true. I imagine it is, because it looks like a little hobby project, not a not like a company trying to pull shit on you. So I think it's interesting. And since it's open source, you could easily host your own version of it as well. So, yeah, it's a cool find. Thanks, Ari.
Nature finds a way, my friend. Nature will always find a way.
Well, that's the original intent of the internet, to route around filtering and damage, right?
Yep.
Well, I mean, so the original intention of the internet, or ARPANET, was to be able to route communications around damaged portions of the network. And then later they figured out that censorship was considered by the network to simply be damage. So it's interesting. So, but
in that phone bot, it was Lenny, not Larry.
Lenny. Yes, video. It's Lenny. Awesome. I need to find that at work and see if I can get the phone guys to give us a forward number for that. I never got him to do it before when I was a smaller company. So now that it, well, anyways, that's all I have. Listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday, or at least as best we can. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the subreddit, the IRC. Tonight in the IRC, we have myself, Sardonyx, Cykros, Iron Angel, and Madman. Madman, closing thoughts.
Oh, I wish I had Lenny already hooked up. I could play it back. I don't have any.
All right, are you future? I mean, closing thoughts.
Madman hooked me up with a good movie last night. What was it?
Drug Across Concrete.
Yeah, a really good film. Do yourself a favor, check that out. And if you're a fan of the band Motley Crue, that biopic they just put out on Netflix is fucking amazing.
Oh, Dirt?
Yeah. Even if you're not a fan, just to go see what those crazy bastards did. And you'll realize how big a puss the latest musicians are. That's it from me.
All right. Well, that's all we got. I'm running a touch long. Looks like we're about 15 minutes over. So, Cykros reminds us in the IRC that season 2 of American Gods is underway. I never watched the first season, but I heard the books were good. So
it is a book, and it is amazing. I've got a copy of it if you want to read it.
We'll talk after the show. So
they changed some of the Coming to Americas in the TV series, which somewhat pissed me off.
Yeah, my wife's into it.
I'm a purist.
Cool. All right, I'm going to hit the Pac-Man sound.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
The stirring, unmistakable patriotism of the Velociraptor holding up a tattered American flag.
Tom's going to nose down and call it a night.